Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will visit with Dr. Dare Bullock, Extension Professor with the Department of Animal and Food Sciences at UK. Our weekly topic will be long-term impacts of the Genetic Improvement Program, or otherwise known as the CAPE Program in Kentucky, for beef cattle. And always, as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
How's David today?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good.
It's a different time being up here on this Eastern time zone, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I'm still not hardly acclimated to this, but, you know, if those folks would just get on God's time and come back to the Central time zone, we'd all be better off.
I agree, 100%.
We have the opportunity to be in Lexington recording this week and hitting a lot of stops while we're here. And
absolutely.
It's fun for me. I grew up in the Eastern time zone. Lexington was the city, so to speak, that we get to come to when I was little. So I enjoy getting to come back up here and see a lot of things that I saw through the years growing up.
Yep.
But we've got a good guest with us today, Dr. Dare Bullock. Morning, sir.
Good morning. Good morning, and welcome to this time zone.
We are glad to be here. There's nothing in the world like waiting till 11 o'clock at night to watch the news.
I used to live in Central time zone for a while, and I can guarantee you that was the best, having the 10 o'clock news.
Yeah, certainly it is. So for those that are listening, why don't you just tell a little bit about yourself and how long you've been at UK and what some of the work is you've done.
All right. Grew up in Williston, Florida, which is north central Florida, I guess, and grew up on a cattle and watermelon farm. We raised about 1,000 head of mama cows and had about 100 acres of watermelons. And if you don't know, that's a lot of watermelons.
That's a lot of cows, too.
Yeah, but the hard work, the fun work was the cows. The hard work was the watermelons.
Absolutely.
No, that was good times, too, though. We had a big crew of all high school boys, and we would and a couple of ladies.
Yeah.
And so we would have a good time with that, too. But helped pay my way through college, so that was good. But I went to school at Auburn and got my undergrad there and worked a couple of years at a research station for Auburn and then got married. And my wife was going to graduate school, so guess what I did? I went to graduate
school. You went to graduate school,
too? That was not the big plan going in, but it all worked out good. And so got to Kentucky in 1992, so this is my 30th year.
Wow.
So it's been a long and good ride.
We're glad to have you here, and that is a nice long time for a career. Hope you don't have any plans on hanging it up anytime soon.
Well, I'm starting to get that itch just a little bit, I'll be honest.
Nothing wrong with having a plan, for sure. So we're going to talk about a lot of different things, but David, if you want to lead us in.
Dr. Bullock's kind of his specialty to me is anything genetic, and, you know, that's kind of what he talks about and you know, tries to teach folks about. Dr. Bullock, you know, as we're coming into, you know, fall calving and that type of thing, and then we're talking about maybe thinking about buying some bulls, and even folks that are listening to this later on that are buying some bulls in the spring, you know, what are some things that we should be looking at? What are some things as far as bull selection? You know, what are some things we need to be keying in on?
Great question, David, because you know that a lot of people go and they look at their bulls and they see a pretty one and then they decide, you know, how can I make this bull fit? And that's not really the right approach to this. What we need folks to do is think about what they want that bull to do. And two big things there is to really make an assessment of what their management is on their operation and how they're going to market the calves. I mean, those are the two big things that we need. So you got to do your homework a little bit. You got to figure out what, you know, how you're going to treat them and how you're going to market them. And if you can figure those two things out, it helps you in that decision process. And let's not forget either that if you're going to keep back replacement heifers or not, because that adds a lot of responsibility to that bull to not only have good feeder calves, but also to have good replacement daughters. I mean, it puts a large burden on that bull.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, when you're trying to sell feeder calves and then hold heifers too, I think those are kind of two opposite ends of the spectrum, if you will, you know, simply from a you know, you're having one bull try to do both of those things.
Absolutely, because for the best feeder calf, we want what? We want some good frame size, and we want a lot of muscling,
yep.
All right? So that turns in that heifer calf, if we put that in a steer and that heifer calf we keep back, if she's packed full of muscling and has a big frame score, she's going to be, what, a 1,600, 1,700-pound cow? And yeah. Guess what?
They're real efficient.
Those girls eat a lot. And so that's it. But, you know, that's we see it all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of gotten out of hand on us a little bit, the mature cow weight on these cows.
I'll tell folks all the time that I guarantee you your cows weigh more than you think they do.
Absolutely. Yes.
And because Kevin and I did a study back on our cows, it was a grazing study, but we actually weighed the cows before we dry lotted them and then put them back. And I mean, we're pushing 1,400 pretty easy. And I mean, that was way bigger than I had thought. And it's actually way bigger than I really want.
Well, and you're right. How many cattlemen push their cows across the scale?
Yep.
Not many at all. They might see the check, but they're just looking at that
when
dollar
they call
sign.
One.
Right,
yeah.
But
yeah.
They're looking at the dollar sign, not what they weigh. But a good indicator is the mature cows that we have in our herd, if you look at slaughter weights, and we all know that slaughter weights have been going up and up and up. I'm guessing it's probably in the 15-plus 100-pound range now. But there's a good correlation between slaughter weight and the actual size of the cows that are back on the farm. So
yep.
That's an indicator that we're going. And if you look at genetic trends in most of the beef breeds, mature weight continues to climb.
Yep. You know, I think something that we often overlook is the genetic makeup of our cow herd. When we're doing a selection of some type of bull, you know, we talked about what the calves are going to be, but, you know, we kind of need to know a little bit about our cow herd before we ever do any of that genetic selection.
Yep, we can correct some things. I mean, and so part of what you're doing with your bull selection is you're trying to produce that next calf crop, but we got to correct errors as we go, too. So if you notice that your cows are getting a little on the large size, we have the tools.
Yeah.
EPDs, expected progeny differences, most of the breeds now give us that mature cow weight EPD as well. So if we've got those really big cows, we can tone them back a little bit by using that EPD and still get some good growth. We don't want to give up the growth. I mean, that's how we get paid. And so not encouraging that, but you said the word efficiency, and that's what we've got to – the big cows eat more.
Well, I've thought that producers need to look across all their cows a little closer. You talk about using that sire selection to correct some problems that we may have. I just think about the genetic differences across the cows and how that selecting a sire may be right for 40% of that herd, but not the other 60. And that goes back to how we built that herd of cows.
Sure. That's a good point, Jay. And what we see a lot of times, what I get concerned with in terms of assessing that cow herd, too, is that we tend to do things easy a lot of times. And the markets have kind of directed us towards this black thing, right? And so the easiest way to do that is go Angus on Angus on Angus. And what do we do there? We've given up all of our good crossbreeding and that heterosis that we can get. And so that concerns me as much as anything. That's probably the first corrective action that most producers need to do is get a little bit better crossbreeding program.
100%.
But, you know, back to your point, though, about the diversity, and that's a good point. The problem is to correct that, you have to have one of two things. Either you have to have two breeding pastures so that you can split your cows up and have a different bull to kind of have the different corrective actions, or you need to do AI. And,
right.
And AI is not out of the realm of possibilities. And I don't know, I think you guys are going to talk to Dr. Anderson too, and he's a big proponent, even in smaller herds, using some AI, and you can target bulls then.
I feel like those smaller herds benefit more from AI than anybody else because they, depending on the size of that herd, owning a bull may create more stress and more problems on your operation than anything else.
It does. And what's that lead to? It leads to year-round calving because it's just too hard to do anything else with the bull.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Producer told me one time, said, you know, that bull up there in that silver can, he said, he's never run over me once. And I remember that. You know, I was actually a dairy producer that told me that. But
it's
the same effect. On a smaller producer, it just takes a whole – section of management out of the equation that you don't have to do anymore.
Yeah.
I'll never forget when I first started as an ag agent, we had a master cattleman program. And that first session, it's about, you know, more of your goals of the operation and just, and it was not on production at all. It was more just about the goals and the business and stuff. And we had each of them to write on a piece of paper why they have cows. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 90% of them was because I just like to fool with cows, or I like to look out my kitchen window and see the cows out in the pasture. And when that's the goal, you know, the whole management, I think that makes it a little bit more difficult because they don't actually, you know, have a plan necessarily sometimes for what they want out of that herd and what, or even what the genetics is in their herd.
Right. And Vicki, we see that all the time. And I have no problem with that. I want people to enjoy the cattle business. But my theory on that is I think you'll enjoy it a lot more if you're making money or not losing so much money than when you're losing money. Because then you've got to explain to your spouse constantly, well, but I like it. Well, that's
not making any money.
That's right. I would hope that folks would, even if they enjoy it, just at least try and put some thought into, well, how can I try and do a little better on the money side of things?
And I think overall, I think we have shifted a little bit more in that direction. You know, I know there's more work and more education to be done, but I do think that we've seen improvements. I think we can all say that about our producers, that they have all kind of more shifted in that direction and trying to make better informed decisions all the way around.
Well, I've tried to remind especially small producers along the way that it doesn't matter what size you are, it doesn't matter what color bull you buy, we're all producing a product that's ultimately going to end up on a consumer's plate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And keeping that in mind helps to focus some people sometimes on making true management decisions and not just something that might suit their fancy.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, let's take a step back and Dr. Bullock, explain what, for those folks that may not know, because we do have some listeners that may be grain folks that may not understand what heterosis is and why heterosis is so important to our cattle producers, especially our commercial cattle producers.
Yeah, it's you know, we talk so much about EPDs and selection and everything else. But if I had to tell a producer the one thing that's going to make him the most money, it would be crossbreeding. And the reason is as you mentioned, heterosis, also called hybrid vigor. And the best way to explain it is basically, and I deal with this with the students, we teach the beef production class, and it's a hard concept to get across. But basically, let's use a trait like weaning weight. If we have a bull that has the genetic potential of 600 pounds of weaning weight, and the cow herd has the genetic potential of 500 pounds of weaning weight, if we were to breed that bull with those cows and there was no such thing as heterosis, what would we expect the weaning weight to be?
550,
just right down the average. But the fact is, it's better than 550. What we actually see and measure and can weigh is maybe 575. Now, what I have to explain to my students, we all don't always get above the highest, you know, of the two breeds. But it's above the average of the two breeds that are brought in. And so a lot of time, what's the first argument there then? Well, then why do you crossbreed? Why not use the better of the two breeds? Mm-hmm. Well, for a different trait, they might flip-flop. And yep. So the cow herd breed might be the, you know, superior for that trait. And it's significant. And so if we look at a trait, my favorite trait of all, I'll tell you my favorite production trait is weaning weight per cow exposed. And so you weigh all the calves at weaning time, divide by how many cows went with the bull, not how many cows you have that day, or even how many calves you have that day, which is a lot of people have 100% because they divide by how many calves they weigh. Well, that's not how it works.
Sure.
You divide by how many cows went with the bull. Mm-hmm. And so now you have a trait that measures gain, It measures reproduction. It measures survivability. All that is built into that one trait. And if you compare what we would call a fully crossbred situation, in other words, we have a crossbred dam cow raising a completely crossbred calf. So let's say an Angus Hereford cow that was mated to a Charolais bull, then we get maximum heterosis, okay? And what we see is you get about a 20 to 25% increase in weaning weight per cow exposed or total productivity compared to the straight bred of any of those three breeds. And so that's a significant increase.
Absolutely.
To get that kind of production. And so I'm going to then, because somebody's going to say, well, that's impossible to get maximum heterosis. And they're right. It is virtually impossible. But let's say you take the easiest crossbreeding plan, which is choose two breeds and just change the breed that you're using every 4 years, we get about half of maximum. So we can still add over 10% increase in production with no added management, really, mm-hmm. no added cost. That's just added return. And so that's how we're getting closer to profitability.
Right.
And hopefully get into profitability.
Right. Kind of talk a little bit about throwing that third breed in there, how important that is, and what percentage that helps you, work
right.
towards that goal.
So if you're in a rotational system, the more breed you add, the more heterosis you get. But it goes under the law of diminishing returns. Remember that. So if you have a two-breed rotation, yes, you get an increase if you add that third breed. And it's fairly significant. But if you add the fourth breed, it's just a little better and so right. forth. So I always encourage producers to never use more than three breeds. I think we can get plenty of heterosis out of three. And I'm not going to fuss at the guy that just has the two, to be quite honest. That's right. better than not doing anything about it. Right. But when we add that third into that rotation, and you can do it the same way. You can still just every 4 years change breeds, but have use three breeds instead of the two. Then you're going to get a little bump to the heterosis as well.
Yeah, I think for years, folks, calvinese was the deal, because that's why we were wanting to go Angus. Mm-hmm. You know, I just don't want to have any calving problems. You know, but I think in a true crossbreeding situation where you do look at the numbers and look at those things, that your calvinese can be just as good as if you were doing, because there's some hard calving Angus bulls out there.
That's
real hard at calving,
right.
You know. So
well, and the other thing was the black at the market. But now, you know, we can do that with almost every breed. There's very few exceptions on being able to get black cattle and calves anymore.
Oh, I agree with that 100%. Explain to folks, and before we get into our main topic, I mean, we've covered a bunch already, but explain to folks about EPDs, about, you know, what they are and what they do for us.
Okay, expected progeny differences. And what it is it's just a measure of the genetic merit for that bull for a lot of the traits that are important to us from a production standpoint. And so, once again, I'll use an example, and let's use weaning weight. Let's say we have a weaning weight EPD of these two bulls. One of them has a plus 30 weaning weight EPD. The other one has a plus 40. That does not mean that the one bull is going to add 30 pounds to your calf and the other one would add 40. You know, that's not how it works exactly, but we want to look at the differences between those two bulls' EPDs, and that's 10 pounds, right, between the 40
right.
and 30. So if we were to breed those two bulls to equal cows, equal management, all things the same, we would expect the heavier or the higher EPD bull, that 40-pound EPD bull, to raise calves that weigh 10 more pounds at weaning than the 30-pound EPD bull. So
right.
that you use them as simple as that. It's just the difference in the two EPDs is the expected difference we would see in the calves. Now, I have to warn people, you're going to have some of that. If you were to do this as a study on your farm, some of that 30-pound bulls, a few of his calves may weigh more than a few of that plus 40, because we still have genetic variation. It doesn't make them all better, but it on average, they're better.
Yeah. And we've got so much genetic differences in our cows, I think, too. And that you know, goes back to what you're talking about.
When sure.
Different bulls will perform with different genetic lines.
That's what I was talking about earlier. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So.
And the other set of traits, David, just to make sure everybody understands, we have what we call direct EPDs, and weaning weight direct is one of those. And that's what we see in that next generation, in the calf crop. We also have what we call maternal EPDs. And so the maternal EPDs are what we expect that bull's daughters, how we expect them to perform. So a good example would be milk or weaning weight maternal. Like mm-hmm. You can see it called different things with different breeds. But what that trait tells us is if there's a 10-pound difference in the milk EPD of the two bulls, it means that bull with the higher value, his daughters, will raise calves that weigh 10 more pounds at weaning because of the added maternal influence that they have, mostly through milk, but there's a few other things that are involved there as well. And so if we're keeping back replacement heifers, we need to take a look at those maternal traits as well.
You know, you touched on something there, that the EPDs from one breed may read differently than EPDs of number. Talk about how producers can educate themselves on the differences amongst the different breeds.
Right, because it's not a one-size-fits-all. That's an excellent point. When we deal with EPDs, we have to educate ourselves within that breed, okay? And so, you know, if you're familiar with, say, the Hereford breed, and you're going to buy a Charolais bull, you don't use the same numbers. Mm-hmm. You have to re-educate yourself. And so what I try and encourage people to do, every one of the breeds that have EPDs, they have a product called an EPD percentile table. Now, you have to be able to get online and look this up. In some breeds, it's harder to find than others. But that EPD percentile table can help you get familiar with the breed, because what it does is it tells you what value of an EPD it takes for that bull to be in the top, say, 10% for a trait, what it takes to be breed average for that trait, or it tells you that bull's, say, in the bottom 10% of that breed. Mm-hmm. And so now you have a little bit a better gauge to look at. And you can do that with, like I say, within the breed. And then kind of if you understand a little bit about the breed, and then you say it's in the top, say, let's say, Simmental. We might be concerned, you know, we want to make sure we have enough calving ease if we're going to breed that Simmental bull to some heifers. So we can go in and we can find that bull, okay, well, he's in the top 15% of the breed for calving ease, so he should do a decent job with the heifers. And we can do that with any trait. Make sure we have enough of those traits, of that trait that mm-hmm. we're looking for.
When you're talking about selecting your bull, and we've talked about knowing your herd and the genetics of your herd, you know, talk a little bit about, because when you start looking at those EPDs and then you start looking at it can get overwhelming quick, but then you see where there's different, we'll say, categories, like where you've got your heifer acceptable or you've got your terminal or your balanced trait.
Right.
Talk about the difference in those and matching up which of those match your herd, or, you know, just talk about that for just a little bit.
So, Vicki, the important thing for people to do is not get overwhelmed to start with, because for any particular situation, there's a handful of EPDs that you need to be considering, and there's very few people that have an extensive an operation that they have to look at a really wide set of EPDs. So if you're a terminal, if you're needing a terminal bull, you're not keeping any heifers back out of this bull, you're just trying to maximize those feeder calves, well, then you can focus on just a couple of traits. The first would be a growth trait, and that needs to be the closest to when you're going to market the calves. If you're selling weaned calves, weaning weight direct EPD. If you're backgrounding them, yearling weight. If you're keeping them all the way through and going to sell carcasses, carcass weight. So focus on that growth trait that's the closest to when you're going to market them. And then make sure that you have enough calving ease that's suitable for that, for your herd.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be different if you're breeding to a bunch of cows versus if you have, say, 50% heifers in that group mm-hmm. or whatever.
Right. Yep.
So getting that, and that I'll just bring this up, getting that calving ease is right is what's important, because it's one of those traits that unfortunately a lot of people think, well, I won't, I need cavities, so I'm going to get as much as I possibly can in that bull. And unfortunately, that's not always the right bull for those folks.
We might end up seeing the results of that when they're trying to grow those calves off. They'll be a little bit behind some of the average of the herd.
That's exactly right. There's very much a genetic correlation between calving ease and growth. So when we just focus on trying to get that maximum calving ease bull, a lot of times we give up growth in the process.
Yeah, I think in the past 20 years in Kentucky, producers have learned a lot about EPDs, and I think of two ways that have been able to really serve as a tool of educating producers. One I'll talk about, just mentioned first, are bred heifer sales.
Mm-hmm.
Producers have learned a lot about EPDs, especially maternal trait EPDs, because of our bred heifer sales. But the second thing I'd like to talk about, and really what we're here to talk about today, is what we'll call it the CAPE program now, but it's held several different names through the years. What the impact of our bull cost share program has done, not only in our herds, but for producers and for them to learn about EPDs as well.
Right.
So.
Good point. And this was one of the first statewide programs that came out of the tobacco cost share. And I want to say that the first county that contacted me was Clark County, I'm pretty sure, and said we want to implement a bull cost share program. What do we need to do? And so I worked with the agents, and then I had a couple of other inquiries about that same time. So there was about three county agents and I kind of worked together and of how we needed to set it up. And we wanted it to be an educational program. We wanted it to be something that it just wasn't, I go buy a bull and I get a check for half of the cost of that bull. I mean, that's nice, but from a University of Kentucky standpoint, we wanted it to be educational and felt like that for the long term, you know, if this money ran out or whatever else, we wanted it to be sustainable past that. And so what we set up is basically categories. We decided that we could help educate producers of doing that. David, I think it was you that mentioned earlier about, you know, deciding what your goals are and mm-hmm. all. Well, if you have certain goals, then there's a certain type of bull that's going to fit that better mm-hmm. than others. And so we kind of came up with some very simple categories. I think we came up with three initially. I think we had the heifer acceptable in case you were breeding a bunch of heifers. Mm-hmm. We had the balanced trait and we had the terminal. I think those three were kind of what got us started. And what the goal of that was is that a producer needed to think through, okay, this is what kind of bull I need. So I need I'm trying to do everything. I'm trying to produce good feeder calves and all that. Well, then a balanced trait bull was probably, but I'm keeping back replacements, so that balanced trait bull would be what they needed. And so we set it up to where they had to have, they had to meet certain EPD guidelines within the breeds. And the other thing that I think we did right about that program was that we said there were no exceptions, that the bull had to have EPDs, they had to have the numbers from their breed association, not that, well, his parents were this, so he's probably mm-hmm. this. I mean, we had to do that. And it's kind of funny, it was not an expected result that we got, was that after about the second year of doing this, I got a call from one of the executives from one of the breed associations, and he said, "What in the world is going on in Kentucky?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "I've had more of my seed stock producers call in and say, how do I get those dadgum EPDs?" And so they were getting flooded, tons of data coming in from Kentucky now, mm-hmm. and our seed stock producers that now, to be able to really market their bulls, they mm-hmm. had to get the EPDs on them, and so they were sending their data in, and so the probably one of the biggest benefits, but one we don't really talk about much, was just that, getting our seed stock guys on board, sending their data in, and having bulls, because not all bulls go through the program, mm-hmm. but now everybody had EPDs to be able to help them make better decisions mm-hmm. with, and so it's kind of gone through, like you say, different gyrations. We've evolved. I'm the geneticist, so we've evolved. And so, but I think it's a really solid program. And another one, I've heard Jim Akers say this multiple times about when you go across the country, people go off about how much we've improved the cattle in Kentucky from a genetic standpoint, health standpoint, all of that. And that's the kind of impact we need. I mean, we can take numbers and everything else, but hearing people from outside of here saying our cattle are better now, I think is a great testament.
Talk with us a little bit about the latest gyration you're talking about, and that's genomic testing.
Right.
Tell us. Explain to us what it is and how that's going to help our producers.
Well, David, as you can expect, what happens when you implement a new rule?
Nobody likes change.
Exactly. And so we've had to deal with some of that. And I can tell you the honest truth, I have to some degree fought some changes in the past when I thought they might have been a little premature, because genomics is one of those technologies that when it first came out, it was premature. Do y'all remember the old star system? We had a one star, a two star bull, and all that sort of stuff. And it was mostly fluff and marketing, and there was really no true benefit to it. But once we got to the stage of now we can get the genomic information that actually goes into the genetic evaluation that produces EPDs and just makes an EPD more accurate and reliable to producers, now we've got a good tool. And so it's not one, you know, tool versus the other. We've got them blended together so that now all you have to do is look at that EPD just like you did before to make your decision. But with the genomics backing it up, in other words, we have these genomically enhanced EPDs, it's just more reliable and more dependable. So once we got to that stage and we decided to implement it into the state program, we gave several years warning that it was coming before, you know, it went into effect. But then when it went into effect, it was once again an all or a none. You know, you had to have it. And so that, unfortunately, as much as you warn, we still had people that got caught off guard to some degrees. We had some seed stock producers that you know, weren't proactive enough and had it already in place. And so that affected some folks. We've kind of, I think, for the most part, cleared that hurdle. There's a few breeds that still don't have genomically enhanced EPDs, and so those breeds were grandfathered in, though. And so all the way through 2023, until December 31st of 2023, those bulls can still qualify, but on January 1st of 2024, all bulls in the program will have to have genomics. And those breeds that don't now, they are some of the, you know, the lesser used breeds in the state. And so so it's not – most of the bulls sold through the program today do have the genomic testing.
Explain to folks that may be listening that may be in the seed stock business that maybe have not ever done any genomic testing.
Okay.
Explain to them, maybe tell them what they need to do and how they need to go about to get their bulls genomic tested.
And I promise you this is not a cop-out, because I would love to be able to just send out a document or tell you guys exactly how to do it and it's going to go through. But unfortunately, I think Jay mentioned it, that the different breeds do things
Everything's a little bit differently.
Yeah, and absolutely. So the first thing I would encourage a seed stock producer to do is contact your breed association and ask them, this is the specific question you need to ask. How can I get genomically enhanced EPDs? Okay. Yeah. Not just how do I genomically test my bull, because you can get you can just do a hair coat test. That's not what we're after. We want to be able to get these genomically enhanced EPDs, and they'll tell you exactly what the process is. Some of the different breeds use the different genomic companies, and so you have to know which company you're dealing with. Most of the time, the breed association will send you the kits to collect the samples. In most cases, that can be, I think all of them accept hair, as an example, and then some will also accept blood and or tissue. And so the tissue is like an ear notch. They even have a tagger that pops out a plug of ear tissue that can be used. But once again, need to work with your breed association. And so that data then, once you get your test kits from the association, you send it in, then that data goes directly from the DNA company back to the breed association so that it goes into the genetic evaluation to produce that bull's EPDs. And it's phenomenal how much information we gain mm-hmm. from that little piece of hair or that blood or that tissue.
I think I was telling them, I think this morning actually, that at the Beef Bash, one of the things that you had said that, you know, that I thought that's amazing that we've come that far is, you know, by being able to do this type of testing, you're able to find out information much quicker than what you would have before, even 2 years out, or, you know, in some instances, you know, it's just being able to have that so much quicker to be able to make some decisions is a huge improvement.
Right. And Vicki, the thing about that is I like to use that example, and I'll go through that example, but then I'll even add a caveat to that, is that for a trait like calving ease direct, okay, if we have a bull tested and send in that data, it's the same as if we were to breed that bull to about 25 cows, and they have their 25 calves, or 25 heifers. We breed them to 25 heifers. Those heifers have their calves, and we take calving ease direct scores on those calves and their birth weights and everything else and go through the genetic evaluation. So we have the equivalent of those 25 calves, but we have it. We can take that sample the day he's born. Usually it's done at weaning or yearling time, and get as much information as having to wait the 2 years, 3 years down the road to have that much data to go in. But the other part of that is that's on the seed stock side of things, because if that bull was bought as a yearling bull and producing commercial calves, he'll never get that level of accuracy because commercial data doesn't go into the genetic evaluation.
Right.
And so, and calving ease, that's the soonest one. If you think about something like milking ability, we get the data, I think, for milking ability, it's about the equivalent of if that bull had 20 heifer daughters that then produced calves so that we could measure and know how much additional milk or, you know, maternal ability they have. And so now we're really talking about 20 years, or I'm sorry, 5 years to be able to get that level of data. Some of our fertility traits, stayability, sustained cow fertility, those are 6 or 7 years down the road before we have the data that's contributed on that. And I think it's about the equivalent of if that bull had 15 daughters, that basically we're talking about before they 8 or 9, 10 years down the mm-hmm. road before we have that data. So, yeah, there's no question about it. It's a tremendous amount of data that and information that we get early. And so we can be much more confident that if that's a calving ease bull, that he's going to truly be a calving ease bull. We make fewer mistakes.
Does that allow the seed stock producer to make these, you know, determinations earlier in a calf's life?
Absolutely.
As to whether
Jay.
Or not he needs to be a breeding bull or whether he needs to be a production steer.
No question about it. And that's what I try and convince, because the seed stock guy is saying, well, that's added cost. Okay. And it is. It's an additional $30 or so that they're doing. But that's an excellent point. I try and tell them that you have now two tools. You can make your decision sooner, so do it at weaning time. And now if that bull, you know, doesn't cut the mustard, you can get him castrated, you can castrate him, put him into the market side of things, or make some decisions along those lines. But you're also providing a more reliable product to your customers, mm-hmm. and the chances of them being repeat customers goes up. And I'm also trying to, trying to convince commercial guys, you can afford to pay $50 more for a genomically enhanced EPD bull. You can afford to pay more than that, but now you're covering the cost of that seed stock guy and you're getting mm-hmm. additional mm-hmm. benefits all at the same time.
To me, the quicker you can gather that information and the more accurate it is, it would add value to that sire line.
No question.
Because you've got that information that much sooner.
Yep.
I mean, I think that's so valuable, the information you can get from that. And somebody that has pulled many a calf from a heifer, you know, and if I can be 25% more accurate on calving knees, I'm going to take it every day, you know. And,
one in four.
Yeah. So I think that is really important, that information is. And that kind of leads us to our timely tip, Jay, if you want to.
Absolutely. You know, we try to add a timely tip there into every show we do, something that's going to be pertinent to the time that the show airs for producers to keep in mind. And this week's timely tip is to know the genetic background of your herd before you're selecting those sire genetics to bring in to make improvements with. I mentioned early on in the show that diversity across our cow herd almost dictates how we select a bull. And to me, you go with those traits in those cows that pick a bull that's going to most serve the bulk of your herd. You're not going to get one that serves them all, or you're going to have to split it into two breeding herds, as you mentioned. But that's kind of our timely tip for the week, is just to know that genetic makeup of your herd before you make these decisions.
Excellent.
Yeah, so. And I also think, you know, we need to add in there about the goals of the operation. I mean, I didn't even think about that when we were coming up with our timely tip, but the goals of our operation need to fit right along with, you know, when we're talking about bull selection, we need to, that kind of needs to be one of the most important things we think about.
I think it's the how you determine all the rest of your decisions as you set that production goal based on the cows that you have. Right. And then that should help you with sire selection. It almost should direct you in your sire selection.
It absolutely should.
Yep.
So. Yep. Well, Derek, we want to appreciate you for coming on with us this week. I think if anybody has anything else to add, if not, we'll...
I think we've about covered it. We've covered a lot of ground this morning. I don't know if I can take it all in or not.
You know, we hardly do one of these shows what we don't get ideas for another show, and I think we could do an entire show just on common EPDs.
Sure.
And or the heritability of certain EPDs, whether you want them or whether you don't, you know. I think we develop a lot of ideas as we go with this.
That sounds like job security for me.
I'll add in, too, that we haven't said anything this, and I don't know if there's an EPD for it or not, but I should know that. I should say that. But for me, another part about selecting a bull that I would like to know is how calm is that bull going to be and how is that bull going to act.
We call that the docility EPD.
Well, I've said here trying to – I'm thinking now, I want to make sure I say that word right, so I just sat here and didn't say it, waiting for you to say it. But that's also important, and I know we're coming up on the end of the time, but I didn't want to leave this without bringing that up, because that is something to think about, and knowing your herd, knowing your facilities – knowing what limits you have as far as facilities, because we want to keep these animals safe. We want to keep ourselves safe, our families, and I think that I would hate to leave this show without bringing that up. If you've got anything more to say about that.
No, that's one of the few traits that I tell producers that's one trait that you look at, both the actual docility of the bull and his EPD. Mm-hmm. And so, because, like you say, he could have a high EPD, but if he wasn't treated right, he could be crazy, and he can, you know, run over your spouse or your kids or whatever else, and that's not done you any good, even though his calves might be docile when you treat them right. And so that's the one trait that we need to look at both, and it's an important trait. It's every producer I ever talked to, the two traits that they all select for is calving ease and docility, for the most part.
I tell you how I learned that back in high school agriculture. My ag teacher had this saying, and he said, "Ignorance breeds ignorance. It's true in animals and people." So you take that for what it's worth.
Probably don't have time, but I got to have one quick comment too.
Oh, you're
because
good.
I'm one of five brothers. My parents had five kids, all boys, and we had a lot of cattle, as you said, and so speed was an important thing. And so my dad wasn't into docile cattle. And my theory was always, his thought was, as I have five boys, I can afford to lose one or two, and I'm still all right. So we did a lot of fence climbing.
I bet. Mm-hmm. I bet.
You learn to hit those steps pretty quick.
You do. You learn the facility you're in and know how to climb that facility the fastest.
And when you're building a facility, a lot of times we think about, I need to have something here where I can get up out of the way.
Steps.
I can exit if I need to.
Yeah, we used to have that when I was growing up. We used to have, you know, you'd have one or two that would get you. And we've about gotten that eliminated, and I sure am glad. You'll still have those outliers that every once in a while that the genetic thing comes into, you'll have an outlier that's kind of silly. And, you know, anytime when they're calves, we try to get rid of those.
Right.
You know, when we wean them and we get rid of them. And I've got – we try to sell bred heifers, and I've got one or two marked off that we have weaned that are a little bit silly when they got in the chute, and they're going down the road. We're not even going to keep them. So folks need to keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I think you, if she's that way, she'll raise one just like her.
Yep,
so.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, once again, Dara, we appreciate you being here with us. We want to thank our host for our information and thank our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show and make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.
Good job, guys. That was perfect. Great, great questions.
Yeah. Well, we try to keep